evening. You're listening to the Parliament of Rooks podcast, episode 13, Talking Backward. Podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Lanise.
And this is his wife, Melanie Lanise.
So, super excited tonight. We are finally done with the preliminary, you know, wave of Silver Age stories. You know, we covered a lot of the introductory stuff, a lot of the one-offs, and finally tonight we are beginning our very first story arc.
Great.
So, you know, as we talked about last week, you know, with the lead in there, you know, with that sort of Golden Age Zatara story, beginning tonight and for the next two episodes, we're going to be covering the story arc called Zatanna's Search.
Nice.
But before we get into all that, we did have a little bit of housekeeping that we wanted to address. Also, as part of last week's episode, you know, we covered a lot of the behind-the-scenes sort of, you know, nitty-gritty stuff about this podcast, you know, specifically, you know, where you could find us on the web. And following, you know, that episode, you know, Mel and I had a bit of a discussion about our Facebook presence. You know, as we had talked about on last week's episode, you know, definitely Twitter has been a huge boon for us as far as our listenership. But Facebook, you know, while one of the first avenues that we began to explore, never really grew in the way that we, you know, expected it to.
Right.
You know, we got a handful of you know, people that joined that group there, but mostly, you know, they were friends of ours, you know, like people that I either knew from Legion World or like, you know, Melanie's, you know, dance friends, you know, were joining that group. But we never really sort of broke out of the borders of our, you know, of our existing friend circle for there. And so we started talking a little bit about why that might be. And we think we hit the answer. Basically, when we first set that up, we did so as a Facebook group. And I don't know if you're familiar at all, you know, with Facebook groups, but there is a bit of, like, exclusivity to them, you know. You actually have to go out and, you know, request that you join them, and then, you know, we as admins would have to add you to that group. Secondarily, a thing that, you know, it sort of adds to the exclusivity is that you actually have to be logged into Facebook to even see it. Like, if we just gave you the link and you went there and you weren't already logged in, you would just see a blank page saying that you have to log in to even see it. And I think accordingly, that might have been a little bit of, you know, discouraging to, you know, to our listenership to actually go ahead and join a group. So what we've decided to do basically is migrate everything that we had been doing over there strictly to just a Facebook page. It does away, like I say, you know, with the whole, you know, asking to have it join it. And then secondarily, you know, it's visible to anybody logged in or, you know, logged out. And then another thing really good about it, you know, from my personal standpoint, is we've talked in the past about unified branding.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the web address that I was able to get to that, you know, finally fits the model that we'd established for everything else, basically TPOR podcast. So our new Facebook page is basically facebook.com/TPOR podcast. So two things, as I say, you know, for our existing group, we're in the process of migrating everybody over. So if you're listening to this and you haven't already done so, feel free to go out and like that page. And then, you know, if you're an existing member of our group, once you do that, I'll go ahead and, you know, dissociate you from that group. And then, you know, once that's all done, I'll just shut it down.
Uh-huh.
Basically, I figure about, you know, like a week and a half or so.
Right. Yeah.
You know, if you've been hesitant about, you know, joining us out on Facebook, now you got no excuse not to. You know, all you got to do is just go out there, hit the little like button on our page, and you know, and you'll be a member of our community. And like I say, and hopefully that sort of then helps our Facebook presence grow and gets more into what I was saying last week. You know, how I envision that as being a sort of back and forth forum,
right,
as opposed to just, you know, posting contents and links and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how it goes. That address once again, facebook.com/TPOR podcast. And as always, you know, now that, you know, is the format for all of our other sites. You know, tporpodcast.com is our website. tborpodcast@gmail.com is our address. At tborpodcast is Twitter. And then, you know, tborpodcast.whateverthehack, you know, go out there and search and you'll find us somewhere, you know. So that's cool.
Didn't we have some feedback as well?
Yeah, that was actually the next thing I was going to say, you know, along the lines of, speaking about Facebook, we did get another comment, from our friend we've mentioned before, Vanessa Valentine, the girl who was asking about the whole Captain Marvel thing, you know, she wants to come on the show and talk about, you know, Shazam and such. She sent us another note, basically asking about another character. Given the fact that we've been doing some spotlight episodes, you know, like Dr. Fate and Johnny Thunder, she was asking, since we have covered the character in a couple stories, whether or not we were going to do any sort of focus on Wonder Woman. So I mentioned this to you before on the show, when we were talking about the origins of all the different superheroes, how Wonder Woman, and you didn't know this at the time, whatever, was actually
made of clay.
Right. She was created magically. No idea. Yeah. But basically the backstory is that Wonder Woman comes from a race of Amazons, you know, on this place called Paradise Island. It's basically a sort of magical island, kind of like an Avalon type thing, you know, sort of hidden from the eyes of man. And her mother, Hippolyta, is the queen of the Amazons. Mm-hmm. So a long time ago, you know, Hippolyta, similar to the whole Pygmalion myth, you know, sort of made a little clay, figure of a girl, and then the gods, you know, breathed life into that. And that, you know, statue later would become the woman that we knew as Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. You know, she would leave Paradise Island. She went through this whole contest where she sort of like won the rights to all of her tools, you know, the
lasso.
The magic lasso, right, and the bracelet she wore or whatever. You know, she won those in a contest and then won the right to represent her people, I guess, you know, in the world of man, basically, to come here and teach us about peace or something. I don't know the whole like golden age or origin of Wonder Woman, but yeah, long story short, you know, so she does have magical elements in her backstory. But that being said, you know, as a character, I don't know that she is necessarily what you would call a magic related character. There's nothing intrinsic in her powers or her stories that is really sort of magic focused. Now, you know, people might counter and say, well, what about Captain Marvel? He's not, you know, magic focused. I would say that he is, honestly. Like, some of the trappings of that particular character, the fact that he's granted his powers by a wizard, you know, Shazam, the fact that he says a magic word to get his powers. There's a whole backstory that we'll get into about the Rock of Eternity, you know, this sort of like mystical realm. Captain Marvel and the Marvel family actually fight a lot of demons and, like, you know, almost satanic type creatures or whatever. That, for my money, is enough to justify him as being a magic character. And to put a fine point on it, and this is what I said to Vanessa as well, is basically like, think about the character, you know, most vulnerable to magic. We talked about this a little bit with Superman, right? You know, they threw that in there to give him, you know, an extra vulnerability so he wasn't like, you know, the most powerful thing ever. So, question, can't answer this question, but I think a lot of people answering it could. What happens when, you know, Superman fights Captain Marvel? He's vulnerable to him because he's a magic-infused character, all right? So the question I put to Vanessa was, well, what would happen if Superman fought Wonder Woman? Well, basically nothing, because she's not a magical, she could not bust through Superman's defenses in that mode. So that, I guess, is where I draw the distinction.
So it was kind of on Vanessa's side until you said that.
Yeah. So, I guess, you know, you could make an argument either way, but, you know, long story short, if we're going to address every single character that has every element of magic associated with it, we'll be dealing with, like, you know, 500 different characters. So we got to draw the line somewhere. And I guess for us personally, you know, that's what we would say, you know, Wonder Woman, not so much. Captain Marvel, yes. Another character that we have looked at thus far that you definitely can make a case for, and we probably will address this aspect of him a little bit later on, is the Golden Age Green Lantern. I think I mentioned a couple times that the Silver Age Green Lantern, you know, got his ring from an alien.
An alien, yeah.
Right. But the Golden Age Green Lantern, we haven't really delved into it, but his ring is actually magic powered. You know, it has a whole long history of, you know, like being created in a certain way and then being passed down through the ages and having, you know, different like magical aspects to it. So he definitely, you know, later in DC history would be presented as a more magic related character. At the time we're looking at, however, not so much. There's definitely going to be a shift in his backstory that puts more emphasis on that. And I think when we reach that point in our narrative, that's when we'll explore him a little bit more. So like I say, all these things basically, you know, are, you know, subjective judgments, you know, that we're making as to what to cover and what not. And hey, if you're listening and, you know, you think otherwise, absolutely take this opportunity and write us. That's tporpodcast@gmail.com. And, and, you know, and let us know if you think, you know, we should. I mean, you know, if you clamor loud enough, you know, let's say, you know, if we get, you know, a sudden flood of emails saying, no, you got to cover Wonder Woman, you know, maybe we will, you know, convince us otherwise.
Vanessa, rally your troops.
Yeah, rally your troops, Vanessa. So, but that being said, that, you know, this is sort of the direction that that we're heading right now. And speaking of the direction we're heading right now, you know, that's a nice segue then. We're talking about one, you know, strong female character. Let's use that then as our segue to talk about our other strong female character, you know, the star of today's show, Zatanna.
Okay.
So yeah, so as we mentioned last week, Zatanna basically is a, you know, creation of Gardner Fox, you know, a different flavor of revival than that which he had been doing in, you know, the other superheroes. You know, basically, he had brought back a couple of different characters as, you know, reinventions, and then he had brought back a lot of those Golden Age characters as revivals. Zatanna, you know, was the first sort of legacy character that he invented. She, you know, she's the daughter of Zatara,
right.
And this story arc that we're going to be looking at basically is her search, you know, for her lost father. We also alluded to this a little bit, you know, last week or whatever. But something unique about this particular story arc is that it is not, you know, a directly linear progression. It's not as though you could buy one issue of Zatanna's Search and then go out, you know, next month and buy the next issue. It actually ran, you know, through various titles over, you know, a series of years. She was basically a guest star in stories of, you know, existing superhero comics. You know, she would pop up, you know, as we'll see tonight, you know, like in an issue of Hawkman, and then, like, you know, some time would pass, you know, 6 to 8 months, and then she would pop up, you know, in an issue of The Atom. All these titles that she appeared in, you know, had a couple unifying factors. And this is going back of, I think, maybe to like episode 3 or 4, but we had talked about the concept of editorial lines, you know, how you would have a certain editor who would oversee like all the Superman comics, like, you know, Mort Weisinger.
To make sure that everything flowed well.
Yeah, that there was consistency, so on and so forth. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, in Mort Weisinger's books, you know, there would be an element introduced in Action Comics that might reoccur in Superman or Jimmy Olsen, so on and so forth. These comics that we've been looking at, for the most part, were basically overseen by an editor by the name of Julius Schwartz. I had mentioned him as a real big force, you know, back in the day to get a lot of those pulp sci-fi writers to come over to DC, you know, because that's where he made his bones, basically. He used to be an old editor of sci-fi pulp magazines. So a lot of the comics that he edited definitely had that bent. You know, they'd be things like, you know, The Flash or The Green Lantern or The Justice League. And then additionally, his go-to writer...
It must be Gardner Fox.
Well, it's Gardner Fox, exactly. You know, a very sort of sympathetic type writer, you know, who had a lot of these intellectual ideas, was very, like, keen on sci-fi, and was able to sort of, you know, create a unified feel across these titles. So Zatanna's Search basically was running through these Julius Schwartz edited, Gardner Fox written titles.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. So the ones that we're going to take a look at, you know, over this and the next couple of weeks, you know, we'll start in Hawkman, which was, you know, a Gardner Fox revival. Then Atom, you know, similar type thing. Green Lantern, you know, and then Detective Comics, where I know I say traditionally that's a Batman comic.
Uh-huh.
But one of the backup features there is something that you would probably really like. We haven't met the character yet, but there's a guy named Elongated Man. It's kind of a mouthful, but basically he's DC's take on an old Golden Age character that you probably do know, Plastic Man. You know, stretchy guy.
I think I've seen him.
Yeah, yeah. You actually, there was a cartoon back in the day. The guy had, like, dark glasses, and he was, like, you know, red costume or whatever. but the reason I say you would like him is because in addition to his superpowers, the conceit of his stories is basically it's him and his wife traveling the country, you know, solving mysteries in every little town that they stop in. So what does that sound like to you?
The Thin Man.
The Thin Man, exactly. for the benefit of our listeners, you know, Melon and I are huge fans of the old sort of 1940s, you know, mystery series called The Thin Men. You know, Nick and Nora Charles are this sort of like socialite couple that travels around solving mysteries with their little terrier. So, like, you know, that is particularly poignant for me and Melanie because, you know, our dog Pippin is a terrier. So, yeah, we adore those. So, but accordingly, yeah, like I say, that's the setup then for Elongated Man. It's, you know, Ralph and his wife Sue, and they travel around and they, you know, find these mysteries, but then, you know, his power helps him solve them, basically. He stretches and so on and so forth. So yes. Anyway, I was saying all that basically to explain that, yeah, that would be the fourth part of the Zatanna story. And then all of this comes together in yet another Julius Schwartz edited, Gardner Fox written title, Justice League. Mm-hmm. You know, okay. So at the end of that, you know, we'll wrap back around and have another one of those, you know, nice long JLA episodes that you love so much.
Oh, yay!
So...
I wonder, though, you know, it's like as I get more familiar with the characters, if I'm going to enjoy those more.
The
you know,
Justice League?
It's got to start coming easier.
Yeah. Like I say, it was a bit of a hurdle when you first started doing this. But yeah, as the weeks go on, you know, you're becoming more and more familiar with this material. So it does become easier, I think.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. So like I say, then tonight's story arc, we're going to begin in late 1964. And before we get too deep into it, I think we should probably just pause a moment and talk about the order that these stories fall in, you know, with the material that we've covered thus far. Like I said before, you know, this is not a linear progression in the sense of month to month. You know, it actually spans several years. So, you know, we've gone thus far in a fairly, you know, chronological progression. With Zatanna's Search, what we're actually going to do is take a couple steps backward and talk about some stories that happened before, some that we've covered thus far. And then as we go through, we're actually going to go deeper than we ever have. You know, we're going to, you know, bypass, you know, 66 and go, you know, into 67 with the conclusion. So the two stories that we're covering tonight are going to be the first chapter, The Girl Who Split in Two from Hawkman, which ran in October of 1964. And so that would have come right after the first JLA-JSA crossover. You know, remember the Crisis on Earth 1 and Crisis on Earth 2?
Yep.
Yeah, when the JSA, you know, first appeared, you know, and there was the Felix Faust and the Wizard and Icicle Kronos thing or whatever. So the very month after that was the first chapter of Zatanna's Search, you know, in Hawkman. And then, for the things that we've covered thus far, the two stories from Showcase that were the Dr. Fate Hourman team-ups, the first one against Solomon Grundy and then the second one against the Psycho Pirate, they would have occurred, you know, in the early months of 1965. And then the month after, you know, Perils of the Psycho Pirate will be then part two of our story, you know, from the Atom, which would be then, you know, June of 1965.
Okay.
So basically it's, what, like 8 months, you know, in between these two stories. So basically sandwiching the Showcase stories and then immediately, you know, subsequent to the Crisis on Earth. And then interestingly, immediately preceding the death of Mark Merlin. So, So it's sort of interesting, you know, pattern, like I say, you know, we're sort of, you know, going, we're weaving this thread in and out of...
Yeah, so she just gets interspersed.
Yeah, our chronology, in the same way that she, you know, was an interweaving thread throughout the DC universe.
Okay.
So the very first story then is The Girl Who Split in Two from Hawkman number 4. Before we get into the story itself, you know, we have seen Hawkman... just peripherally, I think, you know, we've seen him in some advertisements, and then we did see a Hawkman in some of those JLA stories, but it was actually the Golden Age Hawkman. So I may just want to take a moment and explain the whole concept of Hawkman to you.
Okay.
So as we mentioned when we were doing the Johnny Thunder story, Hawkman, the character, first appeared in the first issue of Flash Comics, okay, but this being the Golden Age Hawkman. He was a creation of Gardner Fox and was basically based on elements from the old Flash Gordon newspaper comics. You know, Flash Gordon had gone to a land of, like, you know, flying birdmen type thing. And, you know, so Gardner Fox used that germ of an idea to create the character named Hawkman. What the Golden Age Hawkman's backstory was is that he was basically an archaeologist who was a reincarnation of an ancient Egyptian prince, okay? And this prince had been killed back in the day.
Okay.
And, you know, had been reincarnated throughout the ages. And his most latest incarnation was a fellow named Carter Hall, this archaeologist. And then Carter Hall, I don't know all the details or whatever, but somehow comes to the knowledge that he is the reincarnation of this prince. And then has an affinity for a lot of the trappings of it. You know, he has a fondness for ancient weapons and, you know, so on and so forth. And then he creates, you know, the sort of anti-gravity belt we saw him, you know, do.
Mm-hmm. So he can
that
fly.
Allows him to fly like a hawk. The story goes on, you know,
I'm sorry, it hit me a little late. So if he's flying by the belt, what's the deal with the wings?
I'm not sure. I don't know whether I think we, even in that JLA story, we had talked about this. I'm not sure whether the wings are made out of that same anti-gravity metal as well, or maybe they're just part of like his aerodynamism. You know, maybe they help him fly the way that wings would. I'm not sure.
Okay.
To continue his sort of reincarnation story, a few issues down the road, they introduce, you know, his girlfriend, Shiera, who is the reincarnation of his ancient, you know, Egyptian love. You know, she too has been reincarnated and she becomes the Golden Age Hawk girl. And together they go out and fight crime. And then, I forget the guy's name, Dr. Hathset or something like that, or whatever, you know. But he then is the reincarnation of their ancient villain and he becomes a sort of recurrent thing or whatever.
Oh.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story or whatever. But the Silver Age Hawkman is a completely different type thing. Like I say, you know, a lot of these characters that were revived in, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you know, from Golden Age characters, were done so with a sci-fi bent. You know, suddenly Flash was a police scientist. Suddenly Green Lantern had contacts with aliens. Well, the Silver Age Hawkman actually is an alien. His backstory is, and this is where it gets a little weird as far as like Golden Age to Silver Age character. I mentioned the Golden Age Hawkman is a guy named Carter Hall.
Mm-hmm.
The Silver Age Hawkman is an alien named Katar Hall. It's like it's spelled with a K, and then Hall is H-O-L. And he and his wife, Shiera, also an alien, are from this planet called Thanagar. And they are basically policemen on this planet Thanagar. And the outfit they wear with the wings and the helmet or whatever is their policeman's outfit. That's the way police dress on Thanagar. They're like the Hawk police. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So they came to Earth tracking this alien from their planet, some sort of shapeshifter. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. It's B-Y-T-H. It's either like Bith or Byth or something like that. But anyway, he comes to Earth, you know, they're fleeing their planet, and the Hawks track him here. While they're on his trail, they hook up with, you know, the like police chief of the city or whatever, and he's like, well, we need to create covers for you guys, you know, while you're looking for him. You can't just have aliens roaming the street. He's like, my brother happens to be the museum curator and he's retiring. So I'll tell you what, while you're here, why don't I just install you over as the museum curator? You look for this dude, so on and so forth. And so they do, you know, in this initial story, and you know, and then they capture the guy, but then they decide that, you know what, we could do a bit of service to our planet by staying here on Earth and learning your police techniques and then taking them back to our planet. So yeah, so they maintain these identities basically as museum curators. And then, but then, you know, act as superheroes, you know, in their police garb.
Nice.
And similar to the Golden Age guy, you know, these two have affinity for ancient weapons, but I think they might be more, you know, related to Thanagar. Maybe the fact that he uses, like, maces and so on and so forth is things that they use on his alien planet. He, too, has anti-grav, you know, belt. It's made out of something they call nth metal, you know, sort of super sci-fi metal that, you know, has anti-gravity properties.
You've mentioned that before.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it with regard to Carter Hall, but, you know, I think they call it that, you know, with Katar Hall as well. And let me think, is that all you need to know about the Hawks? The revival was also by Gardner Fox and a very esteemed artist by the name of Joe Kubert. He he's known for a wide variety of things, you know, but I often think of him in terms of being related to Sergeant Rock. They're sort of, you know, war heroes. You know? Yeah. And I actually met Joe Kubert at a comic convention one time. Totally
nice.
Great guy. He recently passed away a couple of years ago, but just wonderful artist and, you know, created a school over in Jersey, I believe, the Joe Kubert Art School that a lot of, you know, esteemed artists later on, you know, went
there?
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet.
So, yeah. So so that's the creation of Hawkman.
We should take a trip one day and go there.
You want to go to the Joe Kubert Art School? I don't know that there's much to see. I think it's like an art school. But, you know, with regard to the character, I'm actually a little bit surprised that, you know, he got his own title. I, you know, throughout my life, you know, I've never particularly been a Hawkman fan. But more to the point, I don't know that I've ever met anyone who is. You know, he's sort of one of those like peripheral characters that you think of, but like, you know, I don't know that anybody's like, oh, I love Hawkman more than anything, you know, whatever. I mean, he just like, he flies and uses like weapons or whatever, you know, but...
Could have impressive artwork. We'll find out soon.
Well, so this is, you know, going to be... some Murphy Anderson artwork, so yeah, you know,
I'm thinking the wings might be particularly impressive.
Yeah, maybe. But anyway, so he got his revival, as I mentioned, in one of those, you know, launch pad titles, you know, similar to Showcase. He actually got his start in the same title that the JLA did, The Brave and the Bold. So where the first, you know, Hawkman, Silver Age Hawkman story appeared, and then they spun him out, you know, into his own title here. He ran for a time, but then I think, you know, as a corollary to what I was saying, that I don't know necessarily that he has a huge bunch of fans, eventually what they wind up doing is merging his title with that of the Atom, you know, who also had his own title, and then they just had a single title called Atom and Hawkman. So maybe they're trying to, like, you know, pool the
power couple.
Yeah, two low, you know, selling titles or whatever into one. So anyway, all that's just background about Hawkman, you know, but the reason we're taking a look at it, like I say, first appearance of Zatanna. So Hawkman number 4 in a story called The Girl Who Split in Two. It was written by Gardner Fox with pencils and inks by Murphy Anderson and letters by Gaspar Saladino. So the first thing we'll do is take a look at the cover, which is, you know, same art, Murphy Anderson on pencils and inks, but letters by Ira Schnapp. And, you know, we'll look at this cover, but, you know, it has nothing to do with the story that we're taking a look at. This actually relates to the second story in here, the machine that magnetized men. It's actually not that great of a cover. It's just, you know, sort of a picture of Hawkman being drawn downward toward what looks to be a huge magnet, right? You know, if he's powered by nth metal, you know, maybe that's magnetic, right. You know, so it's just sort of a POV shot from above, Hawkman being pulled down, and that's it. Not even any purple here to draw you in. Just a lot of drab browns.
Gray.
Yeah, grays and browns. I mean, that's why Hawkman didn't survive in the solo title. So let's crack this one open and take a look inside. And so the first thing we see actually is on the inside cover. We see a sort of public service announcement, you know, that they would run in these, you know, early 60s DC comics. Basically, this one is, smoking is for squares. As we see, you know, two... early 1960s street toughs, you know, pressuring another little crew-cutted boy to take a smoke.
In a suit, no less.
In a suit, right. And in the background, though, we see a poster for Miss Paulette Breen, apparently the winner of the Palisades Amusement Park National Contest, you know, sort of beauty queen. And who should appear to intervene in this peer pressure situation? But Paulette herself, who, you know, striking a rather fetching pose there, you know, points at the toughs and, you know, wards them off, you know, smoking ain't cool, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then so, you know, they get the point, you know, drop their cigarettes and take it from me. Girls who are hip don't flip for fellows who smoke, she says, you know, giving a little wave. Say, if a kitten like Miss American Teenager feels that way, it's good enough for me, says Street Tough. So, way to go, Paulette.
Yay.
So from one, you know, beautiful female to another, we turn to the opening, you know, splash panel, and we see our featured guest today, Miss Zatanna, dressed in her stage costume, you know, top hat and tails, but, you know, basically her father's costume, but...
But with fishnets.
Right, I was going to say from the waist up, yeah.
Like, it's a little different from the waist down.
Yeah, from the waist down, a little, like, leotard bottom and fishnet stockings. And, you know, and she's sort of in the center panel, you know, holding her hands over two little vignettes of the Hawks. You know, to the left we see Hawkman, you know, clubbing out some Asians. And then to the right we see, you know, Hawk Girl, you know, clubbing, it looks like, some street toughs here. As our narration reads, from the museum in Midway City, the trail of the mystery treasures led to the lost city of Yin and to the Hill of Tara in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Confronting Hawkman were Oriental bandits. Facing Hawk Girl were criminals from London. And at trail's end for both was the added mystery of the girl who split in two.
You know, the way they have her hands, it almost looks like she's controlling the scenes as though they were marionette puppets.
Oh, like little puppet master, yeah. Her fingers are already splayed, sort of, you know, dictating the action. So we see credits, you know, like I say, not really common in stories of this era, but story by Gardner Fox and art by Murphy Anderson. And, of course, Murphy Anderson, you know, both these credits are in circles.
Of course, yes, because he's gotten a compass now.
Right. So let's turn the page. As we see, one summer morning, an indignant guide bursting into the office of the Midway City Museum curator, Carter Hall's office. So it's an alien, Katar Hall, but his identity here on Earth is Carter Hall, mm-hmm. the same name as the Golden Age guy.
Yep.
So we see this this guide bursting in saying, "I studied the Oriental Wing all week long, and the very first day on the job, there's something in there I never saw before. I was so embarrassed when a visitor asked me what it was." "But Betty," says Carter, "that can't be." So the college student who works in the museum during her summer vacation leads the way to the Oriental Wing doorway, as Carter says, "Nothing's put on display until I okay it, and I haven't registered any exhibit here in several weeks." "Then what is that?" she says, pointing. In odd surprise, Carter lifts a rare Shang statue. "Incredible," he says, you know, lifting the statue. "This looks like a statue from the lost Chinese city of Yin. We don't own such a thing." As we hear a footfall sounding as, "Mr. Hall, I've been hired to radiocarbonate the objects in the Aaron Room, but this goblet wasn't on the list," says you know, another sort of, you know, museum employee. "A Celtic ceremonial cup," says Carter. "How'd it get in here? I never saw it before." So, clutching the museum's new treasures, Carter enters his office, where his wife, Shiera, acts as his secretary. Just real quick or whatever, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's like Murphy Anderson's art, or like, you know, maybe the fact that, you know, she's like a redhead or whatever. But I always thought Shiera Hall was one of the prettiest sort of like Silver Age characters, you know.
She is really pretty.
Yeah, she's got this sort of like, you know, nice eyes and sort of like, you know, I don't know. She looks intelligent too,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas Carter Hall, as drawn here, you know, sort of has a Tony Curtis element to him. Look at that one up there. That looks like Murphy Anderson might have taken that directly from a movie poster. Kind of looks like Spartacus era Tony Curtis.
It does.
So anyway, Carter comes in and, you know, holding these, says, "Look, dear, a rare Shang statue and an equally priceless Celtic cup." "Marvelous," says Shiera. "Who donated them to the museum?" "I haven't the slightest idea. But that's only part of the mystery. Someone placed them on exhibit here. But when or how, no one knows. Shiera is a puzzler." As Shiera says, "That calls for a special investigation by Hawkman and Hawkgirl." So later that day, after they've donned the Thanagarian police uniforms that have given them their colorful names on Earth, you know, we see them in their costumes still holding these artifacts. "This statue from the Shang Dynasty was reportedly last seen in the lost city of Yin centuries ago," says Hawkman. As Hawkgirl replies, "You go there, dear, while I try to learn how we obtained this goblet from the ruins of the Hill of Tara in Ireland." Soon afterwards, we see Hawkman flying above the Great Wall of China. "It won't take me long to reach the northern Honan province from here," he says. Is that Honan? It's in the Hunan province, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. So anyway, when he swoops out of the sky, his appearance is spotted by the Mongolian bandits. "Look, a birdman," says a Mongolian. "Perhaps he knows we came here to loot the treasures of ancient Yin. And maybe he comes to take them away from us," says another. Fearful of being despoiled of the riches they've uncovered in the ruins, the bandits open fire. "Seem to have stirred up a hornet's nest," thinks Hawkman as the Mongolians are, you know, firing their weapons at him. "I wonder if there's any tie-in with those bandits and the mysterious appearance of the Shang statue," says Hawkman, you know, ducking for cover behind a wall. So, drawing an old-time weapon from his belt, like I say, you know, Hawkman, you know, has a certain affinity for antique weapons.
Mm-hmm.
He hurtles low across the ground, and "this 17th century grenade thrower I brought is perfect for firing stones," thinks Hawkman. "I can pick ammunition off the ground." You know, they had grenades in the 17th century. That's pretty sweet. Really. So the very next moment, as Hawkman fires his weapon, a hail of tiny stones flies through the air. "This won't do anything more than sting those bandits, but it will give me a chance to get within operating distance." So Hawkman darts for cover as the outlaws duck away from the missiles. And as the bandits turn to attack, lifting their own guns, Hawkman begins fanning the air to create a turbulence that'll raise a smoke screen of rock debris between me and them, he thinks. So yeah, he beats his wings and we see, you know, sort of like a sandstorm mm-hmm. rising up as the tiny particles of crumbled stone rain down on the startled bandits. "Cough, cough! Birdman, hide behind the dust!" says a Mongolian, very sort of, you know, stereotypically.
Yeah.
So then, through that sandstorm of rock dust, hurtles the winged warrior, you know, clocking a Mongolian right on the chin. Mighty hands reach through the choking haze to lift, and where his hands cannot reach, his wings whip through the air like feathered fly swatters. "Youch!" says a fellow getting smacked by a Hawkman's wing. What an indignant way to end slap to the wing. So the remaining bandits break and run, seeking refuge within the ruins. "We hide in here, behind locked door," they say, as, you know, they jump into the little fortress. Birdman can't get at us in here while we shoot him easy.
What?
So they begin opening fire, but dodging the hot lead, the Flying Fury seizes a stone dog of foe, apparently a little, you know, gargoyle-looking dog, you know, outside the temple. I'm going to need the weight, thinks Hawkman, to smash that door. This statue ought to do the trick. So gripping that awesome weight in his powerful fingers and flying at terrific speed, Hawkman rockets toward the doorway. From this angle, he thinks, the bullets can't reach me. With a deafening crash, stone dog meets wooden door, as the next moment, through that crumbling door, burst Hawkman. His wings spread to stop the progress as he drops the stone dog and says, I got a kick coming, boys, and here it is. As he kicks the dog and sort of like rolls and flips and bowls them over, basically like a bowling, like they're bowling pins, basically knocking them all over. And so says the narration.
Yes.
Like a massive bowling ball, the dog of foe fells the remaining outlaws. I'll hunt for the clues, thinks Hawkman, about the Shang statue after I take these bandits to local authorities. But suddenly, from a dimly lit corner, a voice rings out, as we see our, you know, mysterious magic girl from our splash page, who says, I azat do ozat, I mu ba pot to ga we. Huh? Says Hawkman, what's that? A painted statue of a girl? No, clearly not, dude. As Hawkman suddenly realizes, no, she's alive and speaking to me in some language I don't understand. Mot habo tab n or, says this not painted statue girl. So moments later, the aerial ace rises through the air with the living statue in his arms. The mystery of the Shang statue can wait, thinks Hawkman, until I solve the problem of this comatose girl. She's not comatose.
Not if she's talking. But then again, I mean, like...
Yeah, she's
very stiff.
Yeah, she's rigid. Yeah, basically like a... Yeah, like light as a feather, stiff as a board.
Yeah.
So, but meanwhile, halfway around the globe in County Meath, Ireland, which we've been there.
Mm-hmm, yep.
That's actually, that's the abbey we went to. We see Hawk Girl flying above the ruins of an ancient abbey. Look, it's Hawk Girl, says somebody on the ground. You think she's working with the London Bobbies or with Scotland Yard? We can't take any chances. Shoot! So suddenly, the quiet Irish countryside is disturbed, you know, with shots ringing out from the window of the abbey. Although, how they're firing from that window, I don't know, because as we would know, there's no floors there. It's just all hollow. So, what in the world, thinks Hawk Girl? Could the goblet have been a trap to lure me here and destroy me? So bullets kick the dirt as the pinioned policewoman scans the rocky ground. Got to find some way of getting inside that ruin. Ah, I see something I can use as a shield. So upward she rises, a flat paving stone gripped in her hands. And I see Hawk Girl headed toward the hail of bullets, you know, deflecting this little paving stone as the story continues on the third page following. But before we get to the girl who's split in two... we see a coupon, you know, for the Palisades Amusement Park. It's second reference in this single issue, but not only Palisades Park, but free admission to a bunch of different parks, which...
all associated parks.
Yeah, well, I don't know, because a couple of these we've been to, right? Dorney Park.
Right? Hershey Park.
Hershey. When I was a little kid, I used to go to Storytown in Lake George, although I think that's been absorbed by a place called the Great
there?
Escape. I think, no, we took Valencia. We took my little niece there when she was a baby. But it's, like I say, it's absorbed by a greater amusement park at this point. So basically just, Palisades Park, you know, in joint operation, you know, with all these other places all around the tri-state area. So anyway, let's continue then with the girl who split in two, part two. So at top speed, the aerial Amazon, Hawk Girl, you know, flies straight toward the open window. Won't nothing stop her, says, Irish gangster. She's going to be inside in another second. So with scant inches to spare, the paving stone moves through the window as Hawk Girl thinks, inside my shield will become a weapon. As like a living battering ram, she hits her assailants. Oof! Oh! Says, they're bowled over by this paving stone. And with a sideways flip of her wings, she rolls over in midair and thinks, that finishes the last one. She kicks him right in the chest. And as she drops lightly to her feet, we see yet again... That girl, you know, talking in strange language. Ma'ana ter fa'ara ste utther di her lift di o'imal. What's this? Says Hawk Girl. That statue, speaking some alien tongue. Is in amazement, we see Hawk Girl studying her discovery. You know, we see her putting an ear down to the girl's chest, saying, a faint heartbeat. She's alive. But why is she so rigid, and what's she trying to tell me? I better fly her to the spaceship and make some tests as soon as I turn those thugs over to the local police. And in the background, you know, we see that traditional, you know, Murphy Anderson, that background, you know, concentric circles. In fact, this is almost lifted directly from the Psycho Pirate story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, being closer to the Thanagarian spaceship, which orbits high above Midway City, we see Hawkgirl arriving before Hawkman and soon working with her super scientific instruments that she keeps there. None of our super scientific devices are able to help her, thinks Hawkgirl. They're super scientific. It's actually quite nice design, right? That's really, you know, cutting edge high tech there for the 60s, you know, sort of pre-Star Trek, but very much, you know, space agey design.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as we see Hawkgirl about to throw another switch, we see Hawkman entering, you know, with his version of the, you know, rigid girl. Great Polaris, says Hawkgirl. You have a twin of the girl I found. She spoke some odd words, says Hawkman. I can't get out of my head. I want to write them down and study them. So no sooner does Hawkman write down what he heard than his wife adds her own version of the strange language, and they combine the two. And they discover, why, she was speaking English the whole time, but only in half words. Let's do what she says. As we see Hawkgirl and Hawkman's, you know, half words combined on a piece of paper. And basically, yeah, you know, when you put them together, it's sort of a, you know, a little word puzzle that reads, I am Zatanna, daughter of Zatara. I must be put together with my other half body to be normal.
There you go.
So they do just that. Gently, they bring the two girls together so that they merge. And you see them sort of like
vibrating.
Yeah, I guess, you know, pushing them or whatever. And yeah, they sort of merge, you know, in like phantom form together into a single girl. As Hawkman says, from our Absorbiscon, we learned that Zatara was a famous magician who fought crime more than a decade ago. And the editor's note says that the Absorbiscon is a remarkable electronic device that enables the winged wonders to gain all knowledge that's known on Earth. So that actually...
Well, that's convenient.
Yeah, well, but that's a standard part of the Hawkman backstory. I neglected to tell you they have this device called the Absorbiscon, and that basically that helped them, you know, learn about Earth, but it also, you know, like, you'd see how they talk to birds at one point. That is the device that enables them to learn the language of birds as well.
Ah.
So as they push the girl together, you know, she, now able to speak in full sentences, says, you did it. Thank you. Thank you. I knew that when I put the Shang statue and the Celtic cup in the museum, you'd save me. Ever since my father, Zatara the magician, mysteriously disappeared several years ago, I've been trying to find out what happened to him. As, we have an editor's note saying that the adventures of Zatara were originally reported in Action and World's Finest Comics. Like, you know, the story we looked at
last
night.
Like we read.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we cut to an outside shot then of the Hawk's spaceship, you know, in geosynchronous orbit. As we see the, you know, the conversation continuing, you know, from our outside perspective as Zatanna continues. I've even followed in his footsteps, fighting criminals between engagements on the stage. I do it in secrecy, so you're the only two who know about it. I also use my magic to search for my father. Magic? Says Hawkman. No wonder our Thanagarian instruments didn't revive you. Zatanna continues in flashback. I use my magic to put myself into trances, during which I try to contact my father. They take a lot out of me, so I can't employ the trances too often. As we see, you know, Zatanna there in flashback, sort of kneeling before, you know, mystic candles, you know, doing her little shtick of speaking backwards. She says, Arata Zaripa Otem, you know, which if we read this backwards says what?
Zatara, appear to me.
Zatara, appear to me. Right. So by speaking the words backwards, Zatanna says, the secret of my father's magic, I attempt to see and hear him with my mind. The last time I went into such a trance, you know, we see her inner trance saying, I've made visual contact. I see the ruins of the lost city of Yin and also the hill of Tyre in Ireland. But which, if any, is a true vision? I remembered, says Zatanna, that my father had spoken of an evil oriental lama he was trying to capture and also of a sinister being called the Druid. And we see, you know, old-fashioned Zatara finally, you know, with his pencil-thin mustache there,
yeah,
flanked on either sides, you know, by this this evil oriental lama and the Druid. So Zatanna wraps up saying, in her haste and eagerness to find her father, she used her magic to split her body in half so she could simultaneously travel to two places. However, though I've studied Zatara's magic, I haven't fully mastered it. So to my dismay, when one half of me, which incidentally had the appearance of my full body, arrived in Yin, I had become immobile. As, you know, we see her flashback and she's there in Yin, thinking, the splitting of my body weakened me, left me with only a small amount of magic power. These bandits looting here don't even realize I'm alive. At the same time, she continues in Ireland, My other half was surrounded by a band of London thieves using the Abbey ruins as a hideout. Looks like the one what's been trailing us. Let's blast her, says the gangster in flashback. What for, says another. She's as stiff as a statue. Can't hurt us none now. I must think of a way to get help, thinks Zatanna. So with the last traces of magic still in my weak and divided body, I teleported a Shang statue and a Celtic goblet to the Midway City Museum. It will take almost all my magic strength to move them, as we see, you know, Zatanna floating this statue and this goblet, leaving me only enough to speak when help arrives. As, you know, we return to the present, as Hawkman questions, but whatever made you single out the Midway City Museum for help? Surely there were other, as Zatanna interrupts, well, with my magical powers, I knew I could get help there from you. And that doesn't sit well with the Hawks.
Right. They
curiously glance at one another, thinking,
does she mean that?
Yeah, she can't possibly know that the Midway City Museum is the secret headquarters of Hawkman and Hawkgirl, and that they're also Mr. and Mrs. Carter Hall. Zatanna, says Hawkman, do you know us in any other identity? And we see a mischievous smile twist the corner of Zatanna's lips. Let's leave things the way they are, she says. I'll go on searching for my father, even though my first contacts were false ones. You continue your own great work, fighting crime. Wait, says Hawkman, maybe I can solve your problem right now. So, donning his Absorbascon, you know, a little headset here, sort of Professor Xavier in Cerebro type thing.
Yeah.
He concentrates, but he says, nothing came through about Zatara. That means no one on Earth has any knowledge of him, knows where he is. Oh, says Zatanna, you know, bringing her hands up to her mouth, then he must be dead. Well, not necessarily, says Hawkman. He still may be alive, but in a state of amnesia. But if there's anything we can ever do to help you find him, please don't hesitate to ask. Then I'll just go on searching, Zatanna says, sighing. Right now, I better get back. So, Anataz Repazid, which means?
Zatanna disappear.
Zatanna disappear. So, before their eyes, the winged wonders watch as the girl magician disappears. I wonder if we'll ever see her again, thinks Hawkgirl. All I know is, says Hawkman, that if she ever needs us, she'll know where to find us, at the Midway City Museum. So, soon after, you know, we see the Hawks exit their spaceship, flying back down to Earth, and say, speaking of the museum, we better turn over the Shang statue and the Celtic cup to the governments of the countries from which they came. I just hope they don't ask us how we got them. They'll never believe the answer we give them. Na 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 na. The end. So yes, that's part one of Zatanna's search. You know, young female magician. You know, engaging the help of Earth superheroes.
And is this her first appearance?
This is her very first appearance. Okay. Yes. So the next superhero then that she would engage, you know, as I said at the outset, would be another Gardner Fox creation.
It's the little guy.
The Atom, exactly. So the Atom, you know, as we would know from the JSA-JLA crossovers, is another Silver Age, you know, revitalization of a Golden Age character. In the Golden Age, the Atom was a college student named Al Pratt, you know, who was basically just a short guy, but really tough. You know, he studied boxing and wrestling and so on and so forth, and would just go out there and, you know, fight crime, you
know. He knows his fighting moves.
With fisticuffs, exactly. The Silver Age Atom, you know, as par for the course with a lot of these, was definitely more a sci-fi type hero. He was a creation of Gardner Fox and an artist named Gil Kane. We'll go into Gil Kane a little bit more in next episode when we talk about Green Lantern. But long story short, he's a very renowned Silver Age artist. You know, worked on the Atom, Green Lantern, and then a couple characters over on the Marvel side as well. Their version of Captain Marvel and some of the you know, horror titles, and then actually some really good Captain America stories. It's a very unique style, and we'll see a little bit of this in the Atom story we're about to do. Two things that jump out at me about his art is his portrayal of eyes always seems very, very unique. He draws very full irises, like, you know, how an eye you'd only see, like, you know, a portion of the iris, it's split by the lids. He tends to have very wide open eyes where you can see the full iris. That whenever I see that, I'm like, oh, that's Gil Kane.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
And then
that will definitely stand out.
Yeah. And then the other thing, similar to Mike Sikowski, remember I always say, you know, Mike Sikowski's money shot where he has everybody in a line or whatever. Gil Kane definitely has another thing that I would call his money shot, and that is somebody being punched and falling over backwards such that you see their face coming forward. You'll see it when we get into the story or whatever, but almost invariably a Gil Kane story will have that shot, somebody getting knocked out toward you, you know.
And oh, okay. Almost 3D.
Yeah, yeah. So, but back to the Atom. So like I say, you know, he's the creation of Gardner Fox and Gil Kane. First appeared in Showcase, you know, similar to the Silver Age Flash and the Silver Age Green Lantern. And his story is that he is a physics professor, okay, named Ray Palmer, which, by the way, happens to be the name of a pulp sci-fi editor, you know, Julius Schwartz, you know, plucked that in the name of one of his buddies or whatever and gave that to the Atom. And so he's a physics professor that was working on matter compression. It's strange. So he
that makes sense.
Was studying white dwarf stars, basically a collapsed star, you know, for which all the matter of it had been, you know, reduced to a very, very small thing, you know, and he was attempting to use it to shrink objects. He had fashioned a piece of this white dwarf star into a lens, but he could never quite get it right. Every time he would shrink it, it would work, but then it would explode. You know, all that matter condensed into it. So he never quite got it right. I read this years ago, so you got to forgive me if I'm getting some of the details of his origin wrong, but I think he was on a field trip with some of his students, like a spelunking thing, and he happened to have the lens like in his pocket, and he gets trapped in like a cave-in. And there's only a tiny little like hole or whatever, you know, that light's coming through. But somehow the water in the cave had touched the lens. So whatever chemical, you know, whatever in the cave mixed with the white dwarf matter. Uh-huh. And then as the light shines through this hole, it refracted through the lens and hits him and makes him shrink. And, you know, so, and he's all afraid. He's like, oh my God, I'm going to explode. Da, 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 da. But then he eventually frees himself from the cave because now he's tiny.
Right.
Goes back, and whatever it was, whatever chemical was special in that cave, was the secret to not letting him explode. So he was able to grow back to normal. And then he's like, oh.
Without exploding,
right. So now really I've got this, you know, this power or whatever. And so he fashions a costume and da da da. And then, as I mentioned to you a little bit, Adam's stories are very much informed by the physics of size. Like, you know, as a physics professor and certainly written by Gardner Fox, he took this opportunity to go, you know, oh, things like weight and momentum and so on and so forth. You know, as you read Adam's stories, these are very important. You know, he's got this tiny little guy, how best to use the physics of my size and weight to affect what I'm trying to do. And,
right.
Yeah, so you'll see some of that. And then his... the other thing I guess is sort of important is the fact that the ability to grow and shrink and then also control his weight is controlled by little controls in his costume. He's got like belt controls and hand controls, so on and so forth. So that's basically the background of the Atom. He works as a professor at a college, but in their physics department.
Nice.
Right. So so as Zatanna, you know, continued her search for her father, time went by, as I say. And so the following year, in June of 1965, she appeared in The Atom, number 19, in a story called The World of the Magic Atom, written by Gardner Fox, with pencils by Gil Kane and inks by Sid Green. So the very first thing let's do is pull up the cover for that, which also penciled by Gil Kane, inked by Murphy Anderson, the artist in the last story we saw, letters by Ira Schnapp, and first... tentative credit for coloring. You know, this would have been the first one we saw in Silver Age. They're saying potentially this might be Jack Adler who did the colors. And, you know, Jack Adler, you know, certainly a company man, went with the, you know, standard...
purple fade.
Purple fade background.
Starts dark purple, fades down to light lavender.
Yeah, exactly. So we know this one's going to be a good seller. So yeah, we see the art here, and we see the druid, you know, that was referred to in the Hawkman story, basically there in full form, you know, and from this goblet, he's conjuring a sort of little dragon.
Flying lizard.
Yeah, flying lizard thing, you know, attacking the Atom, as the druid says, dragon alive, dragon fly, attack Atom, make him die.
Oh, that's not nice.
Well, but we know it's going to be effective because it rhymes.
Right, yes.
So we see the stupendous story of science versus sorcery on the world of the magic Atom. And then in the lower left-hand corner, we have a little inset saying, special guest star, Zatanna the Magician. And first thing, so, but right off the bat, you know, remember the thing I said about Gil Kane and his eyeballs? And take a look at that guy.
Saw it right away. Yeah. And I was like, well, there's a good example.
Yeah, it's like 85% sclera and tiny little you know, irises in there. So let's turn this open. As we see, you know, an inside cover It's just advertisement, you know, for happy hobby time. The other thing, so like in addition to Palisades Park and all this amusement park stuff, another thing that 60s DC Comics are really hepped up on was doing models. I don't know, you'll always see like Cap's hobby hints and stuff like that. Huh. But in this one, you know, Superboy, you know, Superman as a boy is giving little hobby tips to these kids. Let's just move on to our story. As we see our splash panel. Basically a sort of, you know, recreation of what we'd seen on the cover. There's the druid saying, you know, my magic will overcome you, Adam, just as it did Zatanna.
His eyes really very creepy there.
Yeah, just really bug-eyed or whatever. And, you know, in the smoke, you know, rising from his goblet, you know, we see this sort of, you know, prone form there of Zatanna in very sort of a, you know, Christina's World pose, you know, the Wyeth painting. So our text reads, When gangster Biff Parker walked straight through the wall of the National Trust Bank and initiated a strange and eerie sequence of events, which was to expose the double identity of Ray Palmer, research scientist, as the Atom. But this was only the beginning of an amazing adventure which was to lead the Tiny Titan, accompanied by the girl magician known as Zatanna, on a journey to the world of the Magic Atom. Story by Gardner Fox, art by Gil Kane and Sid Green. So, we begin our story. It's a nighttime blackness. It's a midnight shroud over Ivytown. It's four mobsters past the National Trust Bank. Man, says one of the gangsters, how I'd like to get my hands on the greenbacks in there. You've got as much chance as breaking into Fort Knox, says another guy. But jokingly, Biff Parker leans his hand against the marble wall, and if I could just reach through and grab... Huh? As indeed his hand goes right through the wall. Wild excitement tinges his voice as, hey, look, I can walk into the bank, as if the wall wasn't even there. As we see, you know, Biff Parker sort of, you know, fading through the wall. Keep going, Biff, all the way, encourages his fellow gangsters. So as the mob leader steps clear through the wall, he finds himself inside the National Trust building. Wow, what a field day this is going to be for us. Come on, fellas, follow the leader. Apparently the rest of the gangsters, you know, have just as much success because soon, joined by his gang, the mobster, fumbles at the huge bank vault. Oh, dead end, he says, you know, not being able to pass through this. We've been stopped cold. What's good at getting inside the bank if you can't get to the goodies? Keep trying, Biff. Maybe there's a soft spot somewhere else. So he does keep trying. The gang leader angrily kicks his foot at another part of the vault, and indeed, his foot passes right through it.
Soft spot.
Yeah, attaboy, Biff. You had a kick coming, and it paid off. So soon, inside the vault, we see the gangsters, you know, filling their pockets to the bulging point with money. I'm dreaming. I know I'm dreaming all this. Then I hope we never wake up. But it's no dream, however. For the next morning, as Ray the Atom Palmer is driving toward the Ivytown University Research Laboratory where he works, you know, we see the radio come on. And topping this morning's news is last night's sensational $300,000 robbery of the National Trust Bank. All news media have been asked to issue an appeal for the Atom to contact police headquarters at once, calling the Atom, this is an emergency. Ray thinks, what about the bank robbery requires the special services of the Atom?
Right.
But obediently, the young research scientist swings his car toward the center of town. I was all set to put the finishing touches on my new weight and size control device. Now this had to happen. All too often as the Atom, I found it awkward in the midst of some hectic action, or when the going gets rough, to reach down to my belt buckle and change my size or weight. That's going to have to wait, because out of sight of any passersby in a shadowy doorway recess, we see Ray touch his belt controls and begin to shrink so that his invisible when expanded uniform is seen. Oh, that's the other thing I forgot to mention. So Ray Palmer is always wearing his costume.
I was wondering how that would work because there would have to be a significant amount of stretch.
Yeah. So his costume is made out of very, very thin fabric of that white dwarf star. But when he goes to normal size, it's so thin that you can't see it. But then when he shrinks, you know, like there it is. Let's turn the page and see what he does. There's another thing I got to give you an explanation because shortly thereafter, we see the phone ringing in police headquarters and the Atom negotiates his specialized telephone transportation trick. Okay. So I forgot.
He goes through the phone wires?
No. I forgot how many like cool little things there are in the Atom. So what he does is he places a telephone call and then shrinks so tiny that he can ride the electron through the wire as it gets, so when the phone rings, you pick it up and, you know, like normally be the voice, but it's him, he pops out because he's there on the electron.
Right.
Yeah, this is super cool stuff or whatever, completely ludicrous, but it's still super cool. We see him pop out of the phone. Here I am, officers, what's up? an impossible bank robbery, says the cop, you know, like not at all shocked that a man just jumped out of the phone receiver.
I suppose it's happened before. Yeah,
that couldn't have happened, but it did. The bank doors and the windows, they were all locked and barred. The time lock wasn't tampered with. Nobody forced a way in, and yet the evidence is there that the robbers did get in and out. How's that for a stumper? So as the detective talks on, a dreamy look comes into the eyes of the world's smallest superhero. This will be your hardest case, says the commissioner. There's absolutely nothing to go on. Why, I don't think it will be difficult to crack at all. As a matter of fact, I know where the crooks are hiding and how to get them the loot. Because in the Adam's mind eye, he sees them. You know, you see all the crooks like sitting around a table.
Mm-hmm.
So the very next moment...
How's that happening?
Well, we're going to find out. Because the tiny titan leaps outward from the police station and into the air currents, thinking, I'll make myself lighter than a feather and let the wind carry me straight to the crook's hideout. And so we see a bystander going, how about that amazing Adam? He knows where those crooks are by pure scientific deduction. Like, what?
No,
it's not a bystander. Okay, I'm sorry. We're still inside the cop place, you know?
Oh, yeah. He looks like he's standing on the street.
He looks like he's standing on the street, but no, we're
They're looking out of the window.
The window, yeah.
Ah, so. Okay.
So riding the breezes, you know, above the rooftops, we see the Adam dropping downward toward the back porch of a house, thinking scientific deduction had nothing to do with it. Seems more like magic how I know where the thieves are. So we see the Adam slipping through the vents of a kitchen ventilation fan into the fan itself. Luckily for me, he thinks this fan is shut off. So the mobsters don't notice their little visitor. They're too busy eyeing their loot. I still can't believe it, Biff. Things like this only happen in wacky science fiction stories.
Like this one.
Yeah, you know, like the kind that are written by Gardner Fox. Don't knock it, pal. Keep believing it happened, and maybe it'll happen to us again. But with one hand on his way control, the Adam makes his move, thinking, my plan of action calls for me to make myself a little lighter in weight. As gangster says, am I blear-eyed from counting all that bank loot, or is that the Adam I see in this room? As the tiny titan lands with both feet on the steaming coffee pot, spilling the hot liquid and causing the gangsters to scatter. It's the Adam, all right, turning the heat on us. And Adam thinks, this ought to separate them so I can handle them one by one.
Ooh, and divide and conquer.
Yeah, he crashes their percolator, you know, making them jump up from their table. With his orbital momentum, the mighty mite dives from the coffee pot toward the top rung of a bar-back chair. And he goes a sort of gymnast style, you know, toward this. As the gangster says,
high bar.
A bullet will cool him off. But the Adam's hands grip and hold his body as he swings about the bar like an Olympic gymnast. This will build up even more power so that when I let go, I'll hit him with my full 180 pounds. It's awkward, but the only way I can govern my size and weight is to reach down and touch my controls. So we see the Adam, you know, release himself and go swinging feet first, you know, toward the gangster. And landing with the battering impact of a heavyweight boxer. So as he goes, he's tiny, tiny and lightweight, touches his belt, makes himself grow to 180 pounds heavy.
He has more impact.
Exactly. So he clocks him as three revolvers zero in on his somersaulting body, but he drops downward. And the gangster's like, we got him now. Yeah, but he's moving so fast, he ain't a very good target. Wait till he slows down, and then we'll let him have it.
Yeah, Adam, slow down.
But the Adam doesn't slow down, and by the time the tiny titan straightens out, he plops into the open slot of a toaster. Oh, he's ducked for cover, says one of the gangsters.
Can't they just press that down?
Yeah, well, apparently they do. Blast away, either he gets toasted or bullet flattened. So three guns crash as one, but the Adam rises upward on the powerful springs of the toaster, thinking, it's too hot in there for comfort. You know, we see Adam flying through a hail of bullets, feet hitting the barrel of the smoking gun. Here's where I give it the gun, says Adam, landing on the barrel and then jumping up toward the gangster's face. His hands dart downward, even as his body rises upward. As he keeps complaining, what a nuisance, this switching of my weight and size control device. Well, dude, you've been doing it for 19 issues. Like, now
I know, yeah.
It's a problem.
But I think they're trying to emphasize that he was going to change that.
He was going to change it. So as his full strength and 180 pounds, he rams into the surprise monster.
That's the money shot.
Gil Kane money shot. He clocks him, and the dude goes flying over backwards, you know, upside
Seemingly
down.
Seemingly out of the panel.
Right, exactly. It's actually quite cool. We see the Adam continue on with a barrel roll. So he heads for a nearby sink, landing hard on the faucet handle and switching it on. As he leaps to the spray nozzle and directs a stream of blinding water into the face of the oncoming gunman. Next moment, he leaps upward, carrying an iron skillet in his hand. As the gangsters clean out the water, going, can't see! But that doesn't matter to the atom because he drops between them, making a pendulum swing at the skillet. You know, sort of like back and forth, clang, clang,
wow.
Either side. This is actually a really well choreographed fight. Like, look at these two pages back to back, and you know, it's obviously two-dimensional flat panel, but there's so much a sense of motion. I mean, it's beautifully choreographed from one spot to the next, to the next, to the next. I mean, to think that out and then to draw it out. I mean, this Gil Kane is a great artist.
Yeah, absolutely. In this panel in particular. Because he's not just coming out of the front, he's also spilling over. That little bit of fabric is on the side.
On the side
even
of the
panel.
Even
though his hand, it's like he's treating it like a window.
A window, yeah, like the guy's passing through the panel.
Yeah.
You're right. It's really quite beautiful. We will post this on our Facebook group, that being facebook.com/TPORpodcast. Join today.
Plug.
So let's turn the page here. We see on the facing page, we have talked about, you know, models. So here's an ad for models. And this one particularly is for the Dragula, the Munster's car.
Nice.
You can get that and, you know, drive your own little Herman Munster mobile.
That's cool. I would have ordered that.
So let's continue on then with our story. We see a phone call to police headquarters bringing up somewhat odd officers of the law. There they are, officers. Their loot is on the table. I don't know how you did it, Adam, but I won't ask any questions. So,
way to do your job.
Yeah, no, right. It's Ivy Town Police or no Commissioner Gordon.
You say you took care of it for us? Good.
So after the prisoners have been locked up, the Tiny Titan changes back into his civilian identity and drives to his research laboratory. I don't know how I did it either. Thanks, Ray. And for all I know, I'll never find out how I got that mental vision of where the crooks were. Putting that to the side for the time being, he sets to work on his problem of his size and weight control device, thinking, I've tried out a micro-circuit device embedded in the palm of this model atom glove. It works perfectly, flashing an electronic signal to the controls of my belt buckle, just as a remote control device can turn a television set off and on. As my fingertips press in, they push and then slide over a tiny transmitter. This forms a sort of safety catch to prevent it from working accidentally. I'll test it here first, and then transfer the gadget to my real atom gloves. So, after transferring the almost invisible device to his tiny gloves, he shrinks his body, then stands on a tiny scale. Good, he thinks. That means from now on I'll be able to alter my size and weight, even as I'm falling through the air, just by pressing my fingertips to the device inside my gloves. We see him on the scale reading 10 pounds,
mm-hmm.
But suddenly it shifts to 180 pounds instantly. His little experiment is interrupted as the telephone rings. I wonder who that is. So the next moment, you know, thanks to his new remote control device, he grows to full size as Ray Palmer answers the phone.
I didn't think about that, but yeah, he couldn't have picked up the phone.
As little Adam, yeah.
Yeah.
So, hello? I just heard over the radio you captured the bank robbers. In case you're wondering, it was I who told you where to find them. Amazement holds the young scientist in his grip as he gasps out, why are you telling me, Ray Palmer, about this?
And who are you?
Yeah, because you're also the Atom, a secret I was easily able to solve with my magical powers. And since it was I who enabled those men to rob the bank, by magical accident, I thought it was only fair to help you catch them. Now, may I come over and talk to you in person? Scarcely has Ray stammered a yes into the phone, then, that puff of smoke, how? As we see a puff of smoke and appearing in it, my name is Zatanna. I'm a magician, daughter of the great Zatara. As the great puff of smoke disappears, and there appears, you know, our little witchy
fishnet
poo. Yeah, exactly. Our stage magician hero. Zatanna, says Ray. I recall Hawkman speaking of you. He said you were searching for your father. Well, way to just, like, confirm your secret identity there, dude. You could have denied it a little bit. but you know, apparently he's given in. So Zatanna continues, yeah. Yes, my father, who mysteriously disappeared years ago without a trace. Through the help of Hawkman and Hawkgirl and their Absorbiscon, I learned that he's nowhere upon the Earth, or if he is, then no one on Earth knows about it, not even himself. My search had taken me to China, where Hawkman helped me, and to Ireland, where Hawkgirl saved me when I was split in two. Recently, while traveling around the country in my stage tour, I performed feats of magic in Legerdemain, and I cast a new spell, trying to make psychic contact with Zatara. We see the panel almost lifted directly from that Hawkman story. You know,
yeah.
Basically her, sort of mystic spell pose there on her knees as, you know, smoke is coming out of these little things. As she receives a vision of a book. It was that spell which enabled the criminals to rob the National Trust, for my magic created a temporary occult disturbance that affected the atoms of the nearby bank vault. We see the
yep.
smoke rising from her little spell, sort of out the window, accidentally hitting the bank and, I guess, weakening the walls.
Right, for one of those guys to get through.
Yeah, so we go back to modern day as Zatanna continues. I also contacted you by mental magic when I realized what had happened, telling you where to find the criminals and capture them. Now, Kubrapa, which means...
Book appear.
Book appear. Still rather dazed by the unnatural phenomena. After all, he is a scientist. Ray sees a magical tome appear at Zatanna's backward-worded command. This is the book I saw in my trance. It belonged to my father, and he used it often. I have reason to believe he's inside it, in a subatomic world. What? Says Ray Palmer. Unfortunately...
That's a huge book.
Yeah, it's a very large, you know, ancient tome. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with the magical spell that will enable me to go to the subatomic world, but you can, as the Atom. I want to go to that subatomic world and hunt for my father with your help. But that's impossible.
Now, is it impossible for him or for her?
Well, he believes it's impossible for him. So let's, you know, take a look and see how this plays out. As he continues that he can reduce himself in size, but anything else I shrink explodes. Oh, so he's saying it's impossible for her. Anything else explodes when it returns to normal size. I'll gladly go myself, however, to try to find Zatara. But I'm the only one who can direct you there, says Zatanna, so I must go with you. Perhaps with the help of your science and my magic, we can do it. So Ray spreads out a length of woven cloth made from the white dwarf matter from which his own size shrinking costume was formed. You know, this is basically, how do you pound out a star into fabric?
Magic. No, I guess it's not.
It's science.
Science.
So he does so, and as, you know, Zatanna casts another backward spell saying, Etu fraud remat apas otni emutsok, which means what?
White dwarf matter shape into costume.
Yes, as indeed it does. We see a sort of, you know,
with white tails.
Version right, of her stage costume as Ray's like, amazing. So seconds later, the tiny titan is joined by the magic maid, you know, wearing her new white dwarf costume as they both take their places on the book. Your costume is equipped with the same size control device as mine is, Zatanna. I showed you how to work it, so let's go. May our journey be a successful one, wishes Zatanna, as they begin to shrink faster and faster, soon lost inside the atoms of the magical volume. We'll keep our relative sizes, says Adam, as we shrink down into the book, as we see, you know, Ray and Zatanna, you know, disappearing into the fabric of the cover, as the story continues on the next page. World of the Magic Atom, Part 2. Downward into the gaping spaces between the molecules of matter that form the magical book of Zatara drop the two manhunters. All around them are the eerie building blocks of nature, which to their human eyes appear distorted and unreal in the alien realm through which they pass, always growing smaller, ever shrinking in size. As I think Gil Kane is lifting a page out of Murphy Anderson's book. And oh no, okay, he's in his eyeballs. But I'm saying all these like concentric circles, you know, he's like, hey Murphy, show me how you do that trick. But we see our pair, you know, shrinking down into this, you know, subatomic world, which, you know, I'm assuming these must be, you know, their versions of protons and electrons and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably.
So Zatanna's like, you know, have I at long last tracked down my father? And the Atom's thinking, if Zatara is in that subatomic world, why hasn't he ever returned to Earth? But before Ray's question can be answered, a world grows before their eyes as they swoop down on the wings of a gentle breeze. Look, says Zatanna, this subatomic world has inhabitants. That native certainly seems human enough, says the Atom. Can you speak to him with your magic? So the magic maid calls down. Do you know Zatara the magician? Have you ever heard to him? Says Zatanna, you know, calling down to the native, sort of a wizard-looking fellow with a, you know, a big bald head.
He kind of looks like outer spacey, too.
Yeah, a little bit alien. And the man calls up. Only one man can answer that. He who lives upon the red hill of Tara, beyond the great blue forest. So as the two earthlings soar off on a high wind, the alien-looking fellow talks to, you know, apparently sends a message to someone. I have done as you ordered, Druid. I have dispatched them to you. So we flash to a great stone chamber high on the red hill of Tara, where stands the dwelling place of the master of the eldritch wisdoms and lord of all enchantments. It is he who rules this world of Katamor. And we see from this great stone chamber, you know, a voice coming saying, Come, Zatanna, and be dealt the same fate I handed to your father. Come, Adam, and share that deadly doom with your companion, for this is the Druid. In robe and mistletoe wreath, with golden sickle and bronze trumpet, he possesses the dark wizardries of ancient mages. By crystal ball or chirp of bat, he has uncovered the secrets of this alien world he's taken for his own. Yes, Gardner Fox is busting out the prose.
So are you.
And we see the Druid saying, Years ago on Earth, my arch-foe Zatara sought to stop my sinister deeds. But just as he was about to imprison me with magic, I fled from him into this subatomic world of Katamor. But with his magic, he trailed me here, and we fought our less terrible astral Armageddon. As we see a flashback with Zatara and the druid sort of, wielding magic bolts against each other. Yes, the druid thinks, I must destroy him, or he shall make me prisoner for all eternity. As Zatara thinks, I'm resolved to put an end to his evil. But the druid goes on, I won that battle of bewitchments because I learned that by transforming the people of this world into energy beings, we see in flashback he's doing just that, and he's thinking, this strange radiation they give off enables me to absorb the magic by which Zatara seeks to conquer me. And so, every time Zatara used his magic, I drew it into my own body. Thus, I added to my own powers while depriving him of his. And so, we see another shot of the battle, and Zatara is growing weaker with every spell I cast while he grows stronger. So strong am I in magic, says the druid, that I shall now banish you forever into a realm you never even knew existed. Harsh laughter rises into the air of Catamore as the druid climbs to his castle roof. Ha ha! Now the daughter comes to find the father. I shall defeat her as I did him. But first, I must separate her from this tiny earthman with her. The better to concentrate on my magic spells. Yes, the tiny earthman. So as we see Zatanna and the Atom, closing in on the druid, we see his quivering finger pointing at the tiny titan as the other hand lifts high a sorcerous bowl. And then we hear the druid casting a spell. Timor live and bowl form die. Begone, Atom, Timor fly. What's Timor? Oh, Timor, okay. Because as the words right of his eerie enchantment ring out, the tiny titan suddenly finds himself 13 leagues from the Red Hill of Terra, accompanied by the whirling bowl. How'd I get here? Thinks the Atom. And that painted lizard stirring to life. Obviously, the lizard is Timor. And just for the benefit of our listeners, the lizard sort of, is dragon form, sort of a snake-like creature, but with claws and, scaled wings. So there's only time to make a fist and activate his size control device as that awesome creature leaps from the painted pose to livid life. Whew! Is the Atom as he's, grasped by this dragon's claws. If I hadn't given myself that new remote control device, I'd be done for. I could never move my hand to my belt buckle controls in time.
Really working that plot point in, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So shrinking fast, the Atom easily slips out of those closing talons. Since that talon grab didn't work on me, thinks the Atom, the lizard's bound to strike at me another way, with its beak perhaps. So, taking advantage of an updraft, the Atom maneuvers himself into position above his foe, and then, like a skydiver, drops downward. Now to land on its back, thinks the Atom, or it won't be able to reach me. So the Atom drops astride the ensorcelled creature, that flails its wings wildly as it seeks to throw its tiny rider. Yahoo! Says the Atom, melting around his neck. This is better than bronco busting. But the winged lizard, being a magical creation, cannot be broken. Not only is this getting me nowhere, thinks the Atom, it's keeping me from helping Zatanna against the druid. I've got to wrap up this fight right now. So as the eerie beast whips itself through the air close to the whirling bowl, the Atom drives a weighted fist against it, it being the bowl. Mm-hmm. As he says, by shattering the bowl, I should destroy the creature that came from it. And so like sheer magic, the bowl beast fades away to nothingness as, Atom smashes the bowl. That does it, he thinks. Now to find a wind to carry me back to Zatanna and the druid. But meanwhile, at this very moment, Zatanna is testing her magic against the mighty powers of the Archmagician. And she says, Eltsak imok ivela, iruptak et dird. Which, please translate that for me.
Castle, come alive, capture the druid.
Castle, come alive, capture the druid. Like father, like daughter, says the druid. And like Zatara, so will fare Zatanna. But in response to her conjuration, the great stone castle spawns a pair of rock-like hands, that grasp around the druid. You might think you're only a stone's throw from victory, Zatanna, but watch! Because as massive stone fingers release him, the wicked wizard glows with sunlight brilliance. I glow because I'm absorbing your magic into my body. Right, that's his old ploy. So the unnerved magic maid hurls fire magic from the sky and lightning from the air at her demonic adversary, saying, Irif laf gnikthogil baj. Which, go ahead.
That's weird. Fire, fall, lightning, jab?
Yep, she's directing the storm to attack him. Yeah, fire, fall, lightning, jab. But you cannot harm me. Your magic is no greater than that of your father. It failed him as yours shall fail you. Desperately, Zatanna hurls spell after spell, incantation after incantation, at her seemingly invulnerable foe. Ha ha ha! The more magic you use, laughs the druid, the weaker you become, and the stronger you make me. You cannot win! As he strikes a very ominous pose, hands raised to the lightning striking sky.
And eyes a-crazed.
Yeah, Gilkane eyes ablaze as the story continues on the third page following. So let's turn the page. Bypassing the letters page, just pausing to note that we do have another letter from crazed letter hack Guy H. Lilly in the third, which I didn't mention this, the but third. Actually, yeah, well, we mentioned him last time, the letter hack that I remember from my childhood, you know, a guy who just writes letters all the time. Mm, and to illustrate that point, I didn't mention it, but in the Hawkman issue that we just read or whatever, he also had a letter in that letters page as well.
Oh, nice.
So, Guy tearing it up. So let's continue on to the story. With The World of the Magic Atom, Part 3. And it's just a beautiful page here. As, you know, we see Atom, you know, born adrift on air currents, you know, with Zatanna, you know, sort of crushed on the ground. As our narration tells us, out of the sky drops a 6-inch human bullet, shouting encouragement to the despairing girl. All around him, the Atom sees the disappearing enchantments of the magic maid as the druid glows to absorb them. Without her incantations, Zatanna is just a helpless girl facing the dread mage of Cadamore. What can the tiny titan do against sorcery? Zatanna, don't give up, shouts the Atom. We must defeat the druid. But Zatanna's there collapsed. You know, even her top hat has fallen off. And she's saying, it seems impossible. My magic is useless against him because every time I cast a spell, the druid absorbs it and increases his own magical might. And as this is going on, suddenly the druid whirls a golden sickle overhead. Now, Zatanna, I shall dispatch you into that strange realm where I cast Zatara, as he begins his spell. By bone and hair, but as he begins, you know, the Atom thinks, gotta act fast. By oil and air, before he makes Zatanna disappear, I'll put on a disappearing act of my own. As, you know, we see the Atom shrink down to almost nothingness. And so out of that same thin air into which he faded, the tiny titan reappears so close to the jaw of the druid, there's no escaping his flailing fist. So before he gets the words out, the Atom says, maybe magic can't hurt you, but have a taste of my bewitching punch. Wow. he smacks him right in the jaw and he falls backwards. Not quite a Gilkane money shot, but, you know, a little hints of it there. He's fallen backward. So hurled backward by that ferocious blow, the Mage of Cadamore falls to his conjuring chamber. Zatanna's okay, thinks the Atom. Now to put my finishing touch to the druid. But the Atom's forward progress is reversed when bubbles flare out at him from the energy beings. The dissociated natives. Oh, I'm tingling all over, thinks the Atom. I've got to get out of this. As, he's beginning to be surrounded by little, you know, popping energy bubbles. And so as he swept outward over the chamber ledge, he makes himself heavier and drops, thinking, I'll grab hold of this ledge, slip through the stones inside the chamber, and reappear so suddenly that the energy beings won't be able to react in time. So like a microscopic mole, Atom races through the crevices in the stone. I'm almost at the wall of the conjuring room, he thinks. And as he reaches the conjuring room, appearing seemingly out of nowhere on a wooden shelf, he hurls an iron tripod downward. Maybe the magic in this object will counteract the magic in these beings, says Atom as he tosses it down. And amazingly, as the tripod makes contact with one of the glowing energy beings, sure enough, good gosh, thinks the Atom, the energy being turned into a human being. Thanks, says this native, replete with the mohawk.
Yeah.
You freed me from the druid's spells. Actually, it's kind of funny. we'll learn this much, much later on. But mohawks, they're actually kind of a thing with the overall Atom family. The Golden Age Atom, when he changes his costume, you know, from his Golden Age costume to his Silver Age one, sort of has this fin on the top of his head, which resembles a mohawk.
Huh.
And then when they tell the retro stories in that book I told you about by Roy Thomas, the All-Star Squadron, there's another villain slash hero or whatever who's associated with him called the Cyclotron. He too has a mohawk like bit of a costume, but then that guy is the I think the grandfather of a modern inheritor of the Atom power called the Nuclon, who actually can grow, but he actually has a mohawk. So it's kind of funny. Like, so
not
like,
trying to hide it anymore.
Yeah. So just the seeds of mohawk were laid, you know, back in the Silver Age, apparently, with regard to Atom. So with the alien to aid him, the tiny titan keeps up the magical bombardment. As the native says, we must work fast before the druid recovers. With his wizardry, he turned us into energy beings so he could absorb Zatara's magic and so defeat him. As Atom thinks, so long as the druid has his magic, it's impossible to defeat him. But that gives me an idea. And so quickly, the Earth's smallest superhero rides a breeze towards Zatanna, saying, "The druid will come in a moment. Our only chance to overcome him is for you to work another magic spell." Zatanna says, "I wish I could, but he's absorbed all my magical powers." As we see above them the druid moving into view. "I've wasted far too much time with you two," the druid shouts down. "I'm going to cast you both into the realm where I hold Zatara." "Quickly, Zatanna," says Adam, you know, hopping on her shoulder. "Everything depends on this. Do a magic trick." So in answer to that impassioned plea, the magicless maid lifts her hands. "I hope the Adam knows what I'm supposed to be doing," thinks Zatanna. "This bit of stage legerdemain is not true magic at all," she says, you know, sort of doing a stage trick. And the Adam thinks, "I know Zatanna has no magic left, but that's the trick I have in mind." So we see from her sleeves a deck of playing cards going sailing up toward the druid, whose body begins to glow. And Zatanna's thinking, "This is always a standard trick I use in my stage act, you know, basically just, yeah, cards flying out, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. like a, you know,
David no Copperfield at all.
Type thing." Yeah, so the druid says, "You think to overcome me with mere playing cards? Ha! I'll absorb them as I did your other magic." You know, but Zatanna, I don't, what's she doing? She's not thinking. It's a strange word, just for the benefit of people listening, it's a strange word balloon. It's not rounded like they're speaking, but it's not, you know, bubbly like they're you know, thinking. They're sort of, you know, scalloped.
I'm going to say that's thinking.
Maybe it's no, it's not thinking, because thinking would have the little bubbles coming out. Maybe it's like whispering. Maybe they're whispering to each other. So Zatanna says, you know, "Those cards were only stage magic. There was no real magic for the druid to absorb." As the Adam, you know, balancing very cutely on her top hat, says, "Exactly. I planned it that way. Watch what happens now." So suddenly the druid shudders. His legs turn rubbery under him. His hand stabs out for support as, "Growing weak, losing control of my senses." "What happened to him?" says Zatanna. "I told you I had no more magic, Adam. I didn't cast a spell." "I know you didn't," said the Adam, "but the druid thought you did. He absorbed that pseudo-magic into his system, an element his magical body could not tolerate." So what, he absorbed nothing? The element that he couldn't tolerate was nothing?
I guess.
Yeah, so riding the wind currents upward toward the castle portal, the tiny titan and Zatanna stare down at the inert magician. As the Adam says, "Just as a fuse will blow out when overloaded with electricity, so the body of the druid was unable to stand the quote-unquote non-magic. You made his real magic backfire. That's why I urged you to do a magic trick, even though I knew you couldn't." Okay, so I'm going to assume that the druid, when he absorbs, actually has to do, like, you know, a physical force absorption thing, and so maybe the absence of that, you know, let's say, drained
counteracted
him.
Everything he had absorbed.
Right, that's what we're going to say. So yes, they stand over their defeated foe, you know, the Adam balancing on, you know, Zatanna's open palm, says, "Now that he no longer has his magic to sustain him, he's doomed to this state of suspended animation." How he knows that, I have no idea. But Zatanna, you know, replies, "Then he'll never be able to tell me where he sent my father." And as a further consequence of the druid losing his magic powers, the people of Katamore return to normal. As we see, you know, an entire race of mohawked people, yes. "We shall always be grateful to you for saving us," says someone. As another someone says, "Leave the druid here. We shall imprison him. Since he cannot move, he cannot escape." And with the druid's collapse, too, Zatanna has recovered her former magical powers, saying, "Since my father isn't here, we might as well return to our own world, Adam." "I know I can," says the Adam, "but I'm not sure the size control will work in reverse for you." So they give it a shot as the magic maid turns her control dial as the Adam watches tensely. "Will it work?" thinks Adam. "It never has before. In all previous cases, the size-reduced object is blown up before it could return to normal." As we see Zatanna growing, and then suddenly, before the tortured eyes of Earth's smallest superhero, VAROOM! A huge explosion as, you know, Adam's like, "Oh no!" His shoulders rounded with despair, he clicks his own remote-sized control device. "I never should have let her talk me into taking her here. I'm responsible for what happened to her." So, desperately grieving, he grows upward off the world of Katamore and through the vast spaces between the atoms toward the Earth. "I can never forgive myself," he thinks, you know, as he's now passing, you know, growing through these little molecules. Mm-hmm. "In some way, I must make reparation for the doom that Zatanna suffered." But as he reappears in his Ivy University laboratory, "Zatanna, you're alive!" As we see Zatanna, you know, sitting very coquettishly in his, you know, stylish 1960s, you know, bucket chair. "I was quite aware that my magic might not be powerful enough to save me from the explosion if it happens," says Zatanna, "so I relied upon something else to save me. My father's book, which was filled with magic. Moreover, since we were inside a magic atom, I drew upon all that magic to combine it with my own and blasted myself out of Katamore and into your laboratory." It's a bunch of nonsense, Zatanna.
But she's alive, yeah. And that's the important thing.
What will you do now? Says the Atom, you know, balancing on the book. Continue the search for my father, says Zatanna. I'll try to find that secret place into which the Druid exiled him. Perhaps someone like Green Lantern, or The Flash, or even the Justice League of America, or someone from another Gardner Fox-written Julia Schwartz-edited title might be able to help me.
Like, and hint, hint, yeah. Guess where we're going next.
Yeah, exactly. The end. So, yeah. So, that wraps up part two of Zatanna's Search. You know, kind of a neat little story, like I say, you know, hopping around the DCU, just sort of, you know, taking a tour of these superheroes. Very novel idea, you know, for the time. You know, I imagine if you're a little kid, you know, you see this on the stand 6 months after you read a story, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, she's back.
Yeah.
You know, and then for you, this is certainly quite a nice thing because some of these peripheral superheroes, you know, that we've just seen, you know, hinted at or whatever, you're getting a little bit of background.
Yeah.
You know,
learn about tying them in and like, you know, expanding on who they are.
Yeah, the Hawks and the Atom, and then, and just so a little bit of preview or whatever, you know, for next issue, as Zatanna alludes to, yes, she will meet the Green Lantern in our next chapter.
And then and probably then, Flash after that.
Actually, she doesn't meet Flash. The one after that, she's going to meet, I think I said at the beginning of the show, the elongated man, the sort of, you know, Nick Robert Charles Gaines, type guy. Yeah, yeah. So that'll be our next episode. But for this episode, you know, let me turn it over to you then to get your opinions on these stories. You know, what did you think of the first couple chapters here of Zatanna's Search? The first one being the girl who split in two from Hawkman. What did you think about the introduction of Zatanna and you know her little adventure around the world with the Hawks?
It was a really nice debut. Now Hawkman and Hawkgirl, do you just call them the Hawks?
Yeah, so like I do, and you know I think I've heard that. I don't know that I've ever seen that written in comics or whatever. But I think I've heard fans say the Hawks. Yeah, you know, Hawkman and Hawkgirl.
Sounds like a last name.
Yeah, although why they call her Hawkgirl and not Hawkwoman, you know, I'm not sure. But you know, actually,
I was just going to comment on that.
But I think, you know, I think later on they actually do. I think in the mid 70s, you know, Hawk Girl winds up joining the JLA, and I think that's around the time that they, you know, they promote her to Hawk Woman.
Oh, good. Graduation.
Yeah, yeah. But definitely in these early 60s or whatever, I think there was still that sort of, you know, disparate thing, you know, between the genders or whatever, and, you know, the diminutive girl.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and so it was nice to see a contrast with Zatanna coming in and her being a stronger... I don't know, stronger. I mean, like, her being presented as a stronger female lead.
Yeah, I mean, well, definitely. She was the first sort of character that we've seen thus far who was actually, you know, dictating the action. Like, even Wonder Woman, you know, in those JLA right. stories we saw, you know, was always sort of a teammate to her friends or whatever, but always, you know, sort of in a diminished role. You know, yeah, you're right. Zatanna is the first, you know, character, at least that we've seen, that's driving what's happening. She's like, you know, she shows up and she's like, hey, Hawks, I need to do this. And now they're supporting her.
Right, yeah, and like she's already found out information about him, so she's already infiltrated.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it was good to see that kind of thing. And also, just moving on from that, I liked how Gardner Fox, like what he did, like it was really inventive. How like she's already going to be talking backwards, but he like totally expanded on that, and he divided her words between her two halves.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so the Hawks are divided, and she's divided, but in more ways than just physically, like her words are divided.
Yeah, it's kind of like a little like, you know, word puzzle or whatever. Gardner Fox, you know, playing the sort of clever game there, you know, with us or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, reader, can you figure out what's going on?
Yeah, and actually, in one of the panels, like he's actually like gotten the words, and they wrote down what they heard Zatanna say. And then, you know, they matched it up.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the solution. Did you get this, kids?
Yeah. No, and another thing that he infused was the weaponry. You know, like Hawkman's, like, you know, was into ancient weaponry and was using it.
Oh, yeah. Trust me. Yeah. Hawkman stories are if you're a fan of that type of thing, you know, like, you know, ancient weapons or whatever. Yeah. Hawkman is definitely where Gardner Fox got to flex his knowledge, you know, with regard to, you know, arcane, you know, weapons and stuff like that or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure there's some attic book that he pulled out, you know, for graphic reference from Murphy Anderson or whatever.
But it's a great way to sneak in a little education to the kiddies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
and as we talked about, this was totally the era for that, right? You know, that mm-hmm. sort of postcode thing. You know, you need to balance the action adventure, you know, with a little bit of educational content,
right?
You know, and he was absolutely geared up to do just that.
Yeah, and he certainly had the educational background to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, like, the story, although it followed that same pattern of, you know, like here's the Hawk team or whatever team they're dealing with. They're going to split up, solve something, come back together, and then solve the real problem.
Yeah.
Despite that, it seemed really well thought out.
Mm-hmm. So overall then, I see where this is going. Little bird, this one lives, I'm assuming?
Yes, this very one good. Lives.
Okay, so cool. Moving on then to chapter two, the world of the Magic Atom. You know, we met a new artist to us, you know, but, you know, certainly an esteemed fellow in the Silver Age, Mr. Gilkane, and then we explored a little bit more of the cerebral aspect of Gardner Fox's writing, you know, with the atom, you know, basically all that sort of, like I say, you know, physics of size type stuff. So what were your thoughts on the Zatanna Atom crossover?
So let's start with that artwork. Gilkane, yeah. I mean, like, I know you said that he was going to have, like, big irises in his eyes, but, I mean, those eyes were crazy.
Crazy eyes.
And also, I enjoyed how Zatanna's really being presented, and it actually struck me at the end of this story when she was back in the lab, and she's sitting there, and, like, it's a very coy pose that she's in. And that's, like, when it hit me that, like, he was completely different. But also, I mean, like, he's outside of the panel. He's got the depth work that we had seen before. I can't remember the name of the other artist that did that.
Oh, Moore Meskin you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're saying Gilkane has a sort of depth of field. I could see a little bit of that, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, like, a key point of his, but I noticed it in another panel. Mm-hmm. His imagery was good. Like, there's another one that has, like, a red background, and you can see, like, the... like three sizes of the atom as he's shrinking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're just, it's striking.
Cool.
So the atom, I was not impressed with atom before, but I have to say that what I've seen now is really quite remarkable.
Oh, when he was just a little shrinky guy, it wasn't so impressive, but now he really has to give it some thought. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew it was coming because he was strangely smart, or strangely perceptive, I guess would be a better word, kind of like Mark Merlin was before he became Prince Rahman. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, just remarkable. I really like the way, another thing that I guess this is Gardner Fox again, he's making physics accessible. It's easy to understand.
Yeah.
And even though there were some points where, like, they were just, like, driving home, you know, like, I'm going to change this remote. It has to be in my hand and not on my belt. Mm-hmm. You know, and they interwove that into the story. Still, I mean, like, by repetition, you're getting the knowledge as well.
I have a question for you, actually. You know, and this is basically what you're saying about making it accessible. So I'm thinking of that two-page fight sequence, you know, where the atom is sort of, like, flipping around the chair and, like, you know, hitting the dude in the jaw and then, like, landing on the faucet and going and grabbing the frying pan. And I had remarked that it was, you know, sort
good
of, like,
sequence.
Very choreographed action. Well, let me ask you this. As a dancer, you know, what do you think about that? You know, the Adam story, did it appeal to you because of the degree of motion?
Maybe. I mean, I hadn't really considered that before. It could have. I was definitely interested in that particular sequence that you're referring to. Getting back to the artist for a second there, though, I did notice that Gilkane drew the atom with his muscles are very emphasized.
Oh, like, yeah, really, really defined musculature.
Yeah. And I think that in order for him to do that whole sequence, he really needed that musculature. In order to make some of those jumps and to apply that pressure.
Yeah. I'm going to be curious, actually, because the next story that we're going, you know, in this story arc is going to be a Green Lantern story. And that, too, is going to be Gilkane artwork. So maybe keep your eyes peeled and see if some of the elements that you saw in the Atom, you know, you're noticing also in the Green Lantern. You know, check that out. Maybe, you know, with a little bit more, you know, an eye toward, you know, the way that these characters are moving, you know, quote unquote moving. You know,
yeah. So, well, probably in particular with Gilkane because he likes to get outside of the panel.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So then, to put a you know, a cap on this one, you know, what's your overall judgment about you know, part two of Zatanna's search?
I actually like this one even better than the Hawks.
Oh, great!
I knew that would make you happy. I'm really liking that Zatanna has really good character development behind her. And also, she's no slacker either.
Yeah.
I mean, like, she's definitely pulling her own weight and probably a little bit more. So, yeah, obviously the bird lives with this one. And, you know, like, Fly, little birdie, fly.
Cool. All right, great. So our average is going up. And, you know, as I predicted on our last episode, I think you are definitely becoming a comic fan. You know, I need to throw some more females at you. Let's do some Black Canary. You know, she's magic, right? No, that's true. So, all right, great. So like I say, you know, next episode, episode 14, is going to be part two of Zatanna's Search. So with that in mind, you know, I think let's go ahead and call it a night here. Once again, for everyone listening, we want to thank you all for joining us tonight. Just a reiteration, you know, if you'd like, you know, you can go ahead and check out our new Facebook page. That's facebook.com/TPOR podcast, you know, and then additionally, you know, as always, I'd like to, you know, solicit any feedback you might have, and you can write us there at TPOR podcast@gmail.com. So once again, thank you all for joining us, and we hope to see you here next time on the Parliament of Rooks podcast.
Thanks, everybody.
I feel like